That's a beautiful piece. Beautiful. I once rented a house that I found out later to a man who was wanted by the FBI. I found out on the 6 o'clock news when I saw his mugshot. Fortunately, he had moved out by then, but he had already taken off with some money from friends that I had very nicely introduced him to. Some of you have been subject to email spoofing. You get an email that looks like it's from me, saying I'm gonna really need you to go out and get a gift card for $400 or $500 for somebody who has cancer, some gut-wrenching, awful experience. And if you click on the email, my email, you'll see that it's really not from me. And I generally don't sign my emails, God bless you. It's a clue. And sorry to bring up bad memories, but this church for 2.5 years was subject to a minister who didn't deliver his own sermons. Plagiarism, and everybody was fooled, not knowing until he finally confessed up. And in confessing, he lied to you all. But yet you came through it. You did. But we're in good company, I think, for those of us who can be duped and fooled. The CIA, well, the CIA. There's Ana Montez, who was a Cuban spy working at their headquarters. Yeah, and then they found out that all the spies in Cuba were actually double agents working for Fidel Castro. Whoops, not a good moment. And then, of course, there's Aldrich Ames, who turned double agent for the Russians. And in retrospect, after he was caught, the CIA looked back and realized he wasn't very good at it, but he succeeded at not being very good at it for almost a decade. Italian authorities were convinced that Amanda Knox was guilty of killing her roommate based on the evidence that she did not properly show her grief non-verbally to them on the death of her roommate, and therefore she must be guilty. They were convinced. Have you ever had someone lie to you? You've misjudged somebody? Was it someone close to you or a stranger, perhaps? And how did you know? Maybe it was a teeny tiny lie, or maybe it was a whopper. Have you ever played Two Truths and a Lie, the game? We often play it at the new members' dinner. Two truths and a lie. You tell two truths and a lie, and then the other people have to guess which one. So let's play. I had to think long and hard about things I have shared with you in sermons. That was hard. I once did a solo dance in front of an audience of 800 people, having no training or experience in dancing. I went winter camping in the Rockies with a thin, cheap sleeping bag bought at a discount store at 10,000 feet in January. I met actress Amy Adams, but was too terrified to talk to her, despite partying with her for 4 hours. How do we know when someone is lying? It's hard enough in an email or online in social media, but in person, it's also extremely difficult. Let's turn this question around. How do you know when you're lying to yourself? Have you ever had a conviction about something? You just knew you were absolutely correct about something, and you didn't have any evidence to support it, nothing whatsoever. You just knew, like a gut feeling, that you were right. How did you know? Do you know yourself well enough to know how you would react if your life was threatened or the life of someone you loved was threatened? Do you know how you would react? Have you ever had an experience like a deja vu or a mystical experience you could not explain, but you know it was true? it was real, and nobody can convince you otherwise. And this is your truth. Have you ever had that experience of you're looking at evidence that is completely conflicting with something you believe? You know it's true, and there's the evidence right in front of you that says, nope, you're wrong. Most of us would feel what's called cognitive dissonance. We're uncomfortable with this conflict. And most of us dismiss the evidence and choose our belief. Rational beings that we are. There was a study that was done right after the space shuttle Challenger exploded. How many of you remember where you were on January 28th, 1986? Yeah. Would it surprise you to tell you that you may be wrong? So this bright-thinking professor grabbed 44 students within 24 hours after the Challenger exploded and had them put in a journal where they were at the time they found out. Within 24 hours, they wrote it down in a journal, and he kept the journals. And then he tracked them down 2 to 3 years later and said, where were you that awful day that we witnessed the Challenger explode? And this study, by the way, applies to Kennedy, 9/11, any major national experience. Not one of them could accurately tell where they were on January 28th. About 10% came close. So you think you're still absolutely sure about where you were on January 28th, 1986? Yeah, your confidence level just plummeted, didn't it? We have very, very strong emotional attachment to what are called episodic memories. Memories are tricky, and I really want to thank Richard Rossell for putting a book in my hands that completely turned my sermon upside down. Thank you, Richard. There's two ways to think about memories that I found very helpful, semantic versus episodic. Semantic memories are events of facts and figures. We remember our phone number, our address, our social security number. They can be verified from an external source. Episodic memories are things, events, memory flashes, emotional memories, and they're not stable. When we heard about the Challenger or 9/11, we had an impact, but we may have gone into shock, and then we thought about it later, and then we had the emotional memory. We had the emotional impact. And that may be more powerful than we actually remember hearing about it. And that messes things up. This can be, they believe this may be tied to post-traumatic stress disorder. Memories are very, very tricky. What's also compromising our memory and our judgment about if somebody else is lying or we are lying ourselves are things like alcohol, what's going on in our body, drugs, lack of sleep, poor nutrition. All of these impact our capacity to perceive and judge and our memories. These two issues, judging others and judging ourselves, two interrelated issues, come from the same problematic source. Our brains, our capacity to perceive. How do we know, or can we know when somebody is lying to us? Generally, no. Can we tell when we're lying to ourselves? Yeah, not so much. Not so much. Because all of this stems from our underlying issue, and that's our underlying unconscious, which is really what's in charge on most days. Professor Timothy Levine has a new book out who says we want to believe people. We give them the benefit of the doubt. That's why we can't really tell. Even if you are a trained investigator, you're a police detective, you're a CIA spy, we want to believe people. We give them the benefit of the doubt. And that's a good thing. He theorizes that it was part of evolution. Our desire to believe people, it helped create our social bonds. It helps create a cohesive community. So we don't completely break down in total chaos. We need to believe each other. And we know that only a small percentage of people actually lie, that most of us are good and we tell the truth. So we go with that. We just go with that until proven otherwise. How do we know when we're deceiving ourselves? Oh, that gets even more complicated. Well, in fact, you might as well just assume we all are lying to ourselves in any given moment. That just might be easier. In fact, it's so complicated. First of all, when we have a conviction of something, we're right about something, and it gets confirmed. Maybe it's an outside source, some authority, a blessing. Yes, you're right. What's the first thing that happens? Woo-hoo! We feel good, and we've just had a little dopamine hit, a little adrenaline rush, a little, told you so, honey. We try not to do it, but we do. We know. Our nonverbal cues give it away every time. Yeah, told you. It feels good to be right about something. And frankly, it's a little bit addictive. We know people, yeah, who like always have to be right. It's a little bit addictive. That little adrenaline rush, that little dopamine. We also are subject to a strong desire to have things explained to us simply. Patterns that are predictable and understandable. Just give me the summary. There's a certain president that prefers that for his security briefings. Just give me it in pictures. This applies to science. In science, a single unifying theory of the universe is the gold ring for physicists. That's the gold ring. But the more we understand about science and how the universe works, you know what we're discovering? It's incredibly complex. It's not cause and effect. That's out the window. We don't really get, cause and effect doesn't stand up to testing. The more we discover about things like dark matter and energy, the more we're like, oh, we know very little about the universe. Very little. Social sciences show us that our brains, our minds are incredibly conflict. Every perception we have of an experience goes through a filtering process of our biases, our prejudices, racism, classism, sexism. Our own DNA is complicating our experiences. Has a significant influence, our environmental influences, our personal history, and all of those fabulous emotional memories. Everything we experience goes through this weird, twisted filtering system. All swimming around in our subconscious that we can never fully know and understand. In fact, we're constantly reacting before we even know we're reacting. Robert Burton, I'm being certain, believing you are right, even when you're not. Thank you, Richard. I was so right, and now I'm so wrong. He wrote this: feelings of knowing, correctness, conviction, and certainty aren't deliberate conclusions and conscious choices. They are mental sensations that happen to us. I'm going to repeat that. This is Robert Burton. Feelings of knowing, correctness, conviction, and certainty are not deliberate conclusions and conscious choices. We think we're rational, we've plotted, we've thought it out, we've used reason to come to our conclusions. Myth, says Robert Burton. They are mental sensations that happen to us. Our brains are engaged in chemical and electrical reactions. That's the sensation. And he says, this is not a secondary event. It's a primary. And we are fools to not pay attention to this reality about how our brains act. That we will ignore compelling evidence in the face of, oh, but I know better. Religion, which is our area of study today, for every world religion, there is a story, there's a narrative, there are characters, and there is a different point of view about what happened and who said what. There's new rituals, there's new belief systems, there's new power plays, and ultimately each one is trying to answer the ultimate desire for humanity is what is the meaning in our lives, and how do we engage in salvation from suffering and death. World religions, general, and this is my easy, simple, see how easy this is? Summation of religion. It's so obvious. We are seeking an ultimate desire for meaning in our lives and salvation from death and suffering. And do not underestimate the power of this driving to understand ourselves. But that also means there's multiple truths. There's multiple perspectives. Yet, what's driving all this is our desire for knowing, a sense of assurance, to walk on firm ground. Safe harbor is our opening hymn talked about. We yearn for knowing the ground we walk upon, and that our lives have value and are worth living, and we want it explained in a fairly simple way, please. We don't want to live in a world of meaningless and ambiguity and lack of trust. The beautiful reading by Barbara Rode, and it is Barbara, not Kate. Sorry for the error in the order service, that was me. The poem In a Time of Peril, she speaks to that driving desire to have conviction, to have with confidence, to know what truth is with a capital T. As Unitarian Universalists, we hold this up as our fourth principle. This responsible search for truth and meaning, so important to us that we hold it up as a principle. It's a priority in our lives. It's responsible search for truth and meaning. We want it to give us sustenance and depth. We want to know that we know something is right. After all, how can we operate in a world knowing that people are going to lie to us, that we're going to lie to ourselves pretty much all the time? How do we know how to even wake up in the morning knowing that we may just walk ourselves into some corner? Well, it could easily leave a life of mistrust and an existential crisis. Then we'll see if you come to church. So how do we avoid this path of cynicism and despair? That's not a path. That's not a journey. I believe that the journey of life truly comes from wonder, from curiosity, from an openness, the capacity for surprise and mystery that is suddenly opened up within us. This is a fundamental ingredient to the spiritual life, wonder and mystery and joy of discovery. This is who we are as religious people. But the key is to strike a balance. You might say, put it on a spectrum. You put wonder and discovery and joy at one end of the spectrum and an openness. And at the other end of the spectrum, you might put cynicism and despair. And in between, you're going to put doubt. You're going to put skepticism. The joy, the wonder, curiosity, despair at the end. And in between, we're going to move back and forth. But the key is not to tip over into despair. The key is not to tip over to the point where you don't believe anybody or anything, but you hang on to that joy of wonder and curiosity. On any given day, we're going to move around on that spectrum, knowing when it's appropriate and when it's not. The idea that we can have a full life of joy and happiness and truth, to have joy and reason. So this month, the theme of the month is courage. And last week, our intern minister, Tyler Coles, delivered a very beautiful and compelling sermon on the importance of cultivating vulnerability, of being able to ask for help. And I preached a couple weeks ago on how to live in a world where we know we have the capacity for cruelty. And today, I invite you to bring those together. Dear, we are here to develop our courage and a life in the face of these realities. And we do so with humility, that we may get it wrong. There's a Jewish storyteller named Magid of Mezrich. He goes from town to town, telling stories for all who would gather. And one day he arrived in town. He was a little bit early for his storytelling session. And Magid was sitting there when a man walked up, and what he didn't know was this was the town con man. And the man started telling Magid, "Hello, how are you? So nice to be here." And Magid's like, "Yes, how are you? Nice to meet you." And he said, "How's life?" And he says, Con man says, not so much. My wife, very ill, and my kids, too. They must have caught it. Something contagious. It's really been awful. And then last week, I lost my job. Can you believe it? I lost my job. And then just last weekend, my house burnt down. These things happen, you know. It seems like all at once. McGee is horrified, listening to these horrible things to this man and thinking, what can I do? What can I possibly do to help you? And the man says, you know, some financial support would be helpful. Absolutely. I mean, you don't have to give much. Whatever you got would be, that would be helpful. Yes. McGee said, of course. And he dug out his pockets. He had 500 rubles and he handed it over to the kind man. And he said, thank you for your generosity. Thank you. This is just so wonderful. Your generosity is beyond measure. And he went running home, he said, to tell his wife of what's left of his home. A little while later, the townspeople arrived for their storytelling, and McGee shared about his helping this poor man, and would they help too? And the townspeople said, oh no, oh no, 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 McGee, that man, his wife isn't sick, his kids aren't sick. No, no, he didn't lose his job, and his house didn't burn down. McGee just looked up at the heavens and said, thank God. Wonder and joy, humility, the foundation of the spiritual and religious experience, knowing that once in a while, we're going to get conned. Once in a while, we're going to deceive ourselves, and we recognize our limits, but we remain committed to this journey, this path, this openness, and we know we can heal when we come together in community. We can ask ourselves important questions. Who am I? And then here's the next one, and this is hard. Ask those you love, who do you think I am? Does your perception of yourself match the perception of others? Because if there's a disconnect, you got some work to do. But what a powerful tool it would be, a powerful mirror to hold up to ourselves. So two truths and a lie. You're all wondering. Which was the truth? Which was the lie? Well, I did lie to you. So, did I, in fact, dance in front of 800 people having no experience whatsoever? Did I go camping in the wintertime in the Rocky Mountains with a thin sleeping bag? Did I go to a, was I in a party with Amy Adams and ignored her? Well, you guys are not in agreement. Except for the camping, yes. I did lie. I told you that one of those was a lie, and that's a lie. They're all true. I had no, this was an example of how compromised our own brains are, that I convinced myself I could do these things. I had no business dancing in front of 800 people with no experience whatsoever. I was probably awful. I had no business camping in the Rocky Mountains in January with a thin sleeping bag. I'm lucky to be alive. And I had no business ignoring Amy Adams at my brother's wedding. Courage, vulnerability, humility, belief that we can heal when we have been conned. It happens to all of us. That's why we have community, to return to and remind us of our love and compassion. May it be so. Blessed be.